We all think we know Peter Pan.
Right.
I mean, it's the ultimate bedtime story for you to tell your kids,
Oh,
right?
absolutely. Fairies, pirates, the boy who wouldn't grow up.
Exactly. It's practically the definition of innocent escapism. But the story of how Peter Pan was actually written, that is a much messier, darker, and frankly, well, a much more expensive story than anything you'll find in Neverland.
It really is. Today we are taking a deep dive into Finding Neverland, the musical.
Yeah.
And while the show itself is about the magic of creativity, the history behind the production is just a masterclass in how brutal the business of Broadway can be.
It's a clash.
Yeah, a massive clash between art and commerce, imagination and cold hard cash.
And when we say clash, we really aren't kidding.
Yeah.
We have a stack of sources here to go through with you today.
Yes, we do.
We got Wikipedia articles detailing the turbulent production history, the actual synopsis of the show, records of all the creative team changes, and
And the financial reports?
yes, the financial report. The timeline is just wild.
It is.
You have a show that started with one creative team, got completely gutted by a famous producer, rebuilt with a British pop star writing the music,
Yeah.
and then landed on Broadway surrounded by some very serious real-world controversy.
It's really the perfect example of a troubled production. So our mission today is to sift through that wreckage, to understand not just the drama backstage, but what the musical is actually trying to say about grief.
Right.
Because at its core, this isn't really a story about Peter Pan. It's
Yeah.
a story about death.
Cheery start. But let's rewind to the beginning. Most people probably know Finding Neverland from the 2004 Johnny Depp movie.
Right, which was actually based on a play called The Man Who Was Peter Pan by Alan Nee.
Wow, great.
So we are already dealing with an adaptation of an adaptation here.
But the musical didn't just, hop from the screen to the stage smoothly.
Not at all.
It had a massive identity crisis. It premiered in Leicester, England in 2012. And from what the production notes say, it was a totally different beast.
Completely different.
You had a book by Alan Nee, the original playwright, and music by Scott Frankel and Michael Corey.
Right.
And these are legitimate theater guys.
Right.
Grey Gardens, Far From Heaven. They are serious composers.
They are. And that Leicester version was much more, well, it was traditional. It
Yeah.
fit the era. We're talking about 1903 London, so the music reflected that specific historical period.
Makes sense.
But then the producer stepped in,
Harvey Weinstein.
right, and he decided the Leicester version simply wasn't working. So
Oh.
he brought in Barry Weisler as an executive producer, and they didn't just tweak the show, they nuked it.
This is the part that blows my mind. Because usually, if a show needs work, you cut a song, maybe you rewrite a scene,
Sure.
you don't fire the entire creative team.
In this case, they essentially kept the title and the concept and threw out the rest.
Wow.
They brought in Diane Paulus to direct.
And she's known for those high spectacle circus style productions, right? Like Pippin.
Exactly. Very visually driven. And then they hired James Graham to write a new book.
We should probably pause there just to clarify for you. When we say book in a musical, we aren't talking about a novel.
Right. Good point.
We mean the script, the spoken dialogue, the actual narrative structure connecting the songs.
Exactly. Changing the book writer is like keeping the engine of a car, but swapping out the entire chassis and steering wheel while you're driving down the highway.
That sounds dangerous.
It is. It fundamentally changes the DNA of the storytelling. But the biggest shock was the music.
Oh, yeah.
They replaced the theater composers with Gary Barlow and Elliot Kennedy.
Hang on. Gary Barlow, as in the front man of Take That,
The very same.
the British boy band.
Yep.
That seems like a massive tonal pivot.
Yeah.
I mean, you go from Scott Frankel, who writes complex, character-driven theater music, to a guy who writes radio anthems.
Exactly.
Were they trying to make J.M. Barrie sound like he was topping the charts in the 90s?
That was explicitly the goal, actually.
Really?
Yeah, Weinstein and the team wanted a pop sound. They wanted songs that could be played on the top 40 radio, not just in a theater. And this created a really strange dissonance in the final product. You have these characters in Edwardian tweed suits standing around in a highly repressive 1903 societies.
And they're singing power ballads.
Yes, singing these huge power ballads that sound like they belong in a stadium arena.
It's basically Edwardian pop idol.
That is a great way to put it. It creates a sort of tonal whiplash. And we have to talk about the financing behind this entire overhaul because this is where the real world controversy we mentioned gets pretty dark.
Right. I was looking at the source reports on this. In 2017, during the massive investigations into Weinstein, allegations came out regarding AMFAR, the AIDS charity.
Yes.
And I want to be very clear to you listening that we are just reporting what the sources state here. We aren't taking any political or personal sides on this.
Of course.
But the sources say there was a major financial controversy.
Right. The reports alleged that money Weinstein raised for AMFAR was funneled into the production budget for Finding Neverland.
Specifically, during its run at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, right?
Exactly.
That is, man, that is heavy.
It really is.
Your show about believing in fairies and the innocence of childhood, potentially funded by money meant for charity research.
It casts a very long shadow over the whole thing.
Yeah.
It forces you to look at the magic on stage with a much more cynical eye.
Definitely.
Because the show is asking you to clap your hands if you believe, while the machinery behind the curtain is allegedly involved in fraud.
It adds a layer of irony that the writers definitely didn't intend.
No, not at all.
But let's shift back to what was actually happening on stage. Because despite all that backstage chaos, the story they were trying to tell is deeply tragic.
It is.
So we start in London, 1903.
Right.
J.M. Barrie is struggling.
He's at a total dead end. His latest play, The Wedding Guest, is a massive flop.
Right.
And he's walking in the park, Kensington Gardens, just trying to find an idea, and he runs into the Llewellyn Davies family.
Which is Sylvia, a widow, and her four boys.
George, Jack, Michael, and Peter.
And this is the setup for the whole Peter Pan mythos. But the dynamic with the boys isn't really what people expect.
No.
If you know the story, you assume the boy named Peter is the wild, adventurous one, right? The one leading the charge.
That's the natural assumption, but the musical flips it entirely.
How so?
In this version, Peter is the sullen one. He's the kid sitting quietly on the bench while his brothers play. He is grieving his father, and he has essentially decided that play is for babies. He is a cynical adult trapped in a child's body.
So J.M. Barrie, the adult, is the one trying to act like a child.
Yes.
And Peter, the child, is the one acting like a sorrowful adult.
That is the central conflict of the first act. Barrie is trying to unlock Peter's imagination because Barrie himself is trying to escape his own reality.
Which is pretty grim.
Yeah, she's in a loveless marriage with his wife, Mary.
You know, Mary Barrie always gets a raw deal in these retellings.
She really does. In the show, she's practically begging for his attention.
There's that one scene, right?
Yes, there's a heartbreaking moment where she confronts him with his own journal. He's been writing pages and pages about Sylvia and the boys, and there isn't a single word in there about his own wife.
Ouch. It paints Barrie's imagination not as this purely good thing, but almost as a form of neglect.
Exactly.
He's checking out of his real life to go play in a fantasy world, and real people are getting hurt in the process. But then we get to the scene where this clash between stiff reality and wild imagination just explodes. The dinner party.
Oh, this is the Act One showstopper. The song is called We Own the Night.
Set it up for us.
So Barrie invites Sylvia and the boys to a formal dinner party at his house.
All right.
And the guests are wealthy investors and his very intense, strict mother-in-law figure, Mrs. Du Maurier.
It's the classic don't make a scene setup. You can practically hear the ticking clock and the clinking silverware. The tension is awful.
And Barrie just snaps.
Yeah.
He starts visualizing the scene differently. He freezes time. The song kicks in, and suddenly, they aren't just eating dinner. They are dancing on the table. They are making a mockery of the silverware. It's a brilliant visual representation of how Barrie's mind works.
He overwrites the boring parts of life with chaos.
Exactly.
But the chaos isn't always fun. The first act ends on a really psychological note. Barrie is under immense pressure from his producer, Charles Frohman, to finish the play.
Right.
And he starts hallucinating.
This is the song Stronger. And here is just a brilliant piece of staging the actor. The actor who plays Charles Frohman, the demanding producer, also plays Captain Hook.
So the villain of the play is literally the man who signs his paychecks.
Yes, but it's more than just a joke about producers.
Right.
Hook represents Barrie's own dark side. His aggression, his id, basically.
Interesting.
Up until this point, Barrie has been writing a very soft, gentle story. And Hook appears in this hallucination and basically tells him, no, a story needs teeth. A story needs a villain.
I love that. It suggests that Captain Hook isn't some external monster from a pirate ship.
No.
He's the part of Barrie that is angry and frustrated.
Yeah.
And if we connect this back to the real world, you have the character of the tyrannical producer on stage, while the real-life production was being run by Harvey Weinstein.
The parallels are uncomfortable, to say the least.
Yeah.
The villain on stage was a caricature, but the villain in the wings was very real.
Very true.
But this hallucination works for the character. Barry embraces his inner pirate, finishes the script, and we move to Act Two.
And this is where the wheels completely come off for the characters. He brings the finished script to the actors, and they are just baffled.
Completely confused. Imagine being a serious Edwardian actor. You are used to reciting Shakespeare or high melodrama.
Right.
And you get a script that says, enter a dog who is also a nanny.
Yeah.
And the children fly out the window. They think Barry has lost his mind.
They're probably asking, what on earth is a Tinkerbell?
Exactly. They have no idea how to perform it. But while the rehearsal is this funny comedy of errors, the real tragedy is happening at Sylvia's house.
Right. Her health is failing.
Rapidly.
The show uses that old-timey euphemism, doesn't it? A chest cold.
They say chest cold, but we see the blood on the handkerchief. It's clearly cancer or tuberculosis.
Something fatal.
Yes. And the boys know it. This leads to the absolute breaking point for Peter.
The cynical boy.
Right. He screams at Barry that grown-ups lie.
Which is devastating because he's right. I mean, they told him his dad would be okay and he died.
Exactly.
Now they're saying his mom is just under the weather and she's clearly dying. He feels like hope is just a trick.
And this is where the song, When Your Feet Don't Touch the Ground, comes in.
That's a great song.
It's a duet between Barry and Peter. And I think this is really the most important philosophical moment in the entire show.
Why is that?
Because Barry doesn't tell Peter she will get better.
No, he admits that reality is painful.
He tells him that when the world pulls you down, imagination is how you survive.
That's powerful.
It's not about denying the truth. It's about having a place to go when the truth is just too much to bear.
Which perfectly sets up the finale. It's opening night of Peter Pan. The play is a massive hit. The audience is cheering, but Sylvia is too sick to be there.
She can't leave her bed, so Barry brings the play to her.
Right.
They move the entire production, actors, costumes, props, right into the Llewellyn Davies living room.
This is the moment where the stage show really pulls out all the stops.
It creates a beautiful play within a play. The boys get to see their mother watching the story that they inspired.
Yeah.
But then we get to the ending. The Peter Pan story ends and the Finding Neverland metaphorical ending begins.
The glitter storm.
Yes. In the show, Peter Pan, the character from the play, flies in and tells Sylvia it's time to go to Neverland.
And this isn't just her walking off stage left. You have to describe what happens visually here because according to the sources, it's intense.
It is a vortex.
A vortex.
The set essentially dissolves around her. A wind machine kicks up this massive cyclone of gold glitter.
Wow.
Sylvia walks right into the center of it. Her shawl blows away and she is just consumed by this light and wind.
It's a stylized disintegration.
That's exactly what it is. It's beautiful, but it's violent. It makes it explicitly clear that Neverland isn't just a fun island of mermaids.
No.
In this context, Neverland is the afterlife. Sylvia isn't flying away to fight pirates. She is dying.
That hits so hard.
It really does.
And then Barry is left with the four boys. He adopts them.
And the grandmother, Mrs. Dumouriez, finally softens. She sees that Barry's imagination wasn't just silliness.
It had a purpose.
Yes, it was a way to help these boys process the absolute worst thing that could ever happen to them.
So we have this profound story about grief, but we really have to talk about how the real world received it.
Oh, the reception.
Because despite the glitter storm and the emotional weight of the story, the critics were, well, they were not kind.
No, they were not. Ben Brantley at the New York Times essentially said the show was trying way too hard to please everyone.
And this goes right back to that pop strategy we talked about earlier.
The concept album.
Right. Before the show even opened on Broadway, they released an album of the songs performed by pop stars.
Zendaya, John Legend, Nick Jonas, Christina Aguilera.
Wait, Jennifer Lopez sang a song from Finding Neverland?
She did. And the album debuted at number one on the Billboard Cast Albums chart. It was a massive commercial success.
That feels like they were trying to reverse engineer a hit.
How do you mean?
Like, if we get J-Lo to sing it, people will think it's a classic before they've even bought a ticket to the show.
Precisely. It was marketing genius, honestly, but artistic confusion.
Yeah.
It reinforced that feeling that the show was a commercial product first and a piece of theater second, and the industry punished them for it.
Big time.
Despite running for over 500 performances and doing really well at the box office, Finding Neverland received zero Tony Award nominations.
That is brutal. Not even for costumes. or lighting. I mean, they had a glitter tornado.
Nothing. A complete shutout. It was basically the Broadway establishment saying, we see what you're doing with the pop stars and the Weinstein money, and we don't like it.
It's such a strange legacy for a show.
It is.
You have this production that audiences generally loved because it makes you cry, it has incredible spectacle, but the critics and the awards voters treated it like a cynical cash grab.
And yet, the core message of the story still lands. It's fascinating because it reframes the entire Peter Pan mythos for you.
That's what I'm stuck on, thinking about Sylvia walking into that light.
Right.
Because if Neverland is the afterlife,
yeah,
then what does that make Peter Pan?
That is the perfect provocative question to leave you all with today.
Yeah.
Because if Neverland is where you go when you die, then Peter Pan isn't just a mischievous boy. He's a psychopomp.
Psycho what?
A psychopomp.
Okay.
It means a guide of souls.
Like the Grim Reaper?
Exactly like the Grim Reaper, but friendlier. An angel of death who looks like a child so you aren't afraid to go with him.
Wow. That completely changes the famous line from the play. To die will be an awfully big adventure.
It certainly does. It suggests that growing up isn't the tragedy. The tragedy is never getting the chance to grow up.
Yeah.
Peter Pan is the boy who stopped, not because he refused to age, but perhaps because he couldn't.
Well, on that existential bombshell, I think I need to go call my mom.
Good idea.
This has been a wild ride through one of the messiest backstories on Broadway.
It's a great reminder that even the most magical stories usually have a very complicated reality behind them.
Absolutely. Thanks for unpacking this with us. To everyone listening, keep your feet on the ground, but maybe keep a window open just in case.
Just watch out for the glitter.
See you on the next deep dive.